And this is KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California in Irvine. And this is Tani Tinuviel here today on What Would Arwen Do? A Middle Earth Elf's Perspective on Life, Community, and the Arts. And if you're a little familiar with J.R. Tolkien, you know that he was himself a Christian, and he was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, who was a great Christian apologist. I love, one of my favorite pieces of literature in the whole world is J.R.R. Tolkien's The Silmarillion. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the Lord of the Rings stories, but there's actually a whole background and story in the history of the elves, which is The Silmarillion, which is the Silmarils were some jewels of Middle-earth. But J.R. Tolkien actually himself wrote a creation story, which would be a creation myth. And it is just beautiful. I'm going to read a little paragraph from this just real quickly. This is the Ainu Lindali, which that is an Elvish word that means the music of the Ainur. And it starts out, "There was Eru, the one who in Arda is called Iluvatar. And he made first the Ainur, the holy ones, that were the offspring of his thought, and they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music, and they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long while they sang only each alone, or but few together, while the rest hearkened. For each comprehended only that part of the mind of Iluvatar, from which he came, and in the understanding of their brethren they grew but slowly. Yet ever they listened, yet ever as they listened, they came to deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony." And if you'd like to read more about that, that is in the first part of the Silmarillion. I love this. It reminds me very much of the creation story in the Bible. And there is a lot of controversy about whether the creation story in the Bible is just another creation myth, or whether actually that is the story of how human beings came into being. And so the question today for this elf is, is there a supernatural cause for why we were here, we are here, or is that a myth? And that's one of the things that evolution and creation talk about. So today we're going to delve into that topic a little bit more with my special guests. Dr. Hugh Ross, who is the author of Creation as Science, a Testable Model Approach to End the Creation Evolution Wars, and he is president and founder of Reasons to Believe. Their website is www.reasons.org, and he is also co-host of the weekly web radio broadcast Creation Update. Dr. Ross has developed a scientifically testable, falsifiable creation model that he suggests bring the creation evolution debate into the arena of testable science. And then my other guest is Dr. Eugenie Scott, author of Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools. And she is the executive director of the National Center for Science Education. She has been both a researcher and an activist in the creationism evolution controversy for over 20 years. And Dr. Ross, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, welcome. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Dr. Scott, are you there?
I am indeed. Hello, Tani. Hello, Hugh.
Hello.
Well, it's wonderful to have you two here on, and I'm very interested to see what each of you have to say, because you each have a different position about creationism and evolution, and yet you, I think you agree on something. We often hear about creation and evolution and the battle about that's going on, about whether or not it should be taught in our classrooms. And evolution being that life, has come into being, the origin of humans and the universe has come about by naturalistic processes, or creationism, which suggests that there is a supernatural cause to the creation of man and the origins of the universe. And so if it's okay, since we only have about 30 minutes, I'm just going to kind of pose a few questions, because I really want my listeners to hear from you guys and not from me. So would that be okay with both of you?
Sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, first, I think I would like to address this question to Dr. Scott first. Just what is your position on the concept of intelligent design, that there is an intelligent cause to the universe and the proposition that life came from a supernatural rather than strictly naturalistic cause?
Well, I think, Tani, you're making this a dichotomous choice, and that is not doing justice to the complexity of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in your introduction to this topic, you seem to be couching it in terms of, well, it's either all naturalistic and God had nothing to do with it, or it's creation, for example, as one would see in the Bible. And there certainly are a whole range of positions on this issue, including an intermediate one, which is that, yes, evolution happened. The galaxy evolved, the planet evolved, living things evolved, but God was very much involved. God did have something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of possibilities here. And what this most recent book that I mentioned, Not in Our Classrooms, is all about, mm-hmm. is what do we teach in the public school science class,
mm-hmm.
and what we should be teaching is science. Now, there are many religious views about whether God acted, how God acted, but none of those, in my opinion, are testable scientifically because God is omnipotent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think here's an area where Hugh and I might disagree.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ross, what would you say to that?
Well, I agree with that this is a complex issue, that there are many positions on the creation-evolution spectrum, not just two or three.
Mm-hmm.
That's a point I make in my book, Creation of Science. And I would also agree with Dr. Scott that we should only entertain those explanations or models that are testable, falsifiable, and predictive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lay out a creation model in the book that meets those requirements. I also try to show how it has explanatory scope. I think much of what passes for intelligent design, for example, is extremely limited explanatory scope. They might be able to explain, for example, the structure of certain biomolecules, but they really don't offer you a complete explanation for the origin and history of the universe, of life and human beings. So we try to do that in the creation of science, and then we boldly make predictions. In fact, what we try to do is take the four predominant models, the theistic evolutionary model, the strictly naturalistic model, the young earth creationist model, and our reasons to believe creation model, which is an old earth perspective, and then we lay out 90 different predictions that would flow from the four different models. And I purposely picked predictions that have the likelihood of being discovered within the next few years,
mm-hmm.
and therefore after a few years we'll know which of those models is successful in making its predictions and which ones are failing. But I also make the point that there's more than those four options. And really what I'm trying to do is kind of set the stage for a vigorous scientific investigation and testing of all manner of creation evolutionary models, but I fully agree we should only entertain those models that are testable, falsifiable, predictive, and of wide explanatory scope.
Yeah, well, certainly we agree on intelligent design in that regard, because intelligent design, unfortunately, makes really no predictions whatsoever. Intelligent design is that was your original question, Donna, is
mm-hmm.
kind of what did I think of intelligent
mm-hmm.
design? And the way I look at it is that it's a simplification of an earlier special creation view that focuses on the alleged weaknesses of especially biological evolution. And because, in their view, biological evolution can't explain modern diversity of life and so forth. Therefore, it had to be poofed into existence by a supernatural creator. Well, that is fine as a religious view if one wishes to hold it, but it certainly can't be demonstrated scientifically, and therefore, indeed, not in our classrooms. It
mm-hmm.
should not be taught. It should not be advocated as a scientific view or as a scholarly view, really, in the public schools.
Now, do you think, though, if those who believe, you know, in a creation perspective, if they were to come up with a model that could be tested, what do you think about that? Because it seems to me that has been the problem in the past, that there is this kind of poof theory.
Well, there's two things going on here. You've got what happened and the cause of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to what happened, that is something that we can study scientifically. We can make inferences about the past based upon matter and energy, based upon material evidence, based upon the methods of science. And when we do that, we find that a number of the claims of, for example, the young Earth creationists that Hugh criticizes in his book simply do not match what we know from the history of the world based on just standard science. Now, when we're dealing with the cause of what happens, did he create the bacteria flagellum in its present form? Did God create the cosmos as we see it, or did he bring it about through a gradual process? The idea of creation, of the omnipotent God's actions, is something that you simply cannot test because of God's omnipotence. In order to test something scientifically, you've got to hold constant certain variables. You can't hold God constant. You can't put God in a test tube. You can't control God's actions. So basically, any kind of statement you would make about the past is compatible with God's actions. So that, therefore, you can't really test supernatural explanations like that. So you're kind of on your own when it comes to the ultimate cause of things. But we can all study, I mean, a creationist or a materialist, anyone can use the methods of science to figure out what happened. But we can't use the methods of science to figure out who done it.
Well, what about the concept, and Dr. Russ, perhaps I'd like for you to respond to that and maybe...
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, I have a much more optimistic view of science. I see science as, of course, very powerful in being able to explore the what, the when, and the where. But I also see it as potent to be able to explain the how and the why and the cause. And I give many examples in my book of how science really does have the power to explore the cause. And this is something that not just Christians would claim, but many leading atheist science researchers would fully concur that science today really does have that kind of power. I mean, if I were to quote, for example, from Fong Liji, he's mainland China's leading scientist, and he wrote a book a number of years ago, and this is a direct quote. He says, "A question that has always been considered a topic of metaphysics or theology, the creation of the universe, has now become an area of active research in physics." And what he refers to in the book is that astrophysicists now have the tools to explore the nature of the cause of the universe. For example, they've been able to establish through their tests on the theory of general relativity that the causal agent for the universe brings the universe into existence completely independent of space, time, matter, and energy. Well, what we're doing there is actually identifying the nature of the cause of the universe. And so this is one example out of many where science is really able to explore not only the cause, but the nature of the cause, how that cause operates on the universe.
Now, see,
I
have a tough time being convinced by that because you have a particular view in mind of the nature of the causer of the universe. You come from a Christian tradition. Someone coming from a different religious tradition, and there sure are plenty of religious traditions around the planet, in addition to the, you know, to the world religions, you have plenty of tribal religions and,
sure,
and many other views. Someone coming from a different tradition would have different expectations, and I'm not convinced yet, Hugh, that using the methods of science, you would necessarily point the finger at the Christian God, but of course this is the point
that
you make.
I think that's a factor, that we come from different ends of the scientific spectrum. I'm working in the simple sciences, you're working in the complex sciences, and in physics and astronomy, where you have great rigor and the things we investigate do obey differential equations, we're actually able to put to the test, say, the Hindu worldview of the universe, the Buddhist worldview, the Islamic worldview, the Christian worldview, and this has been routine for the past 20 years. I mean, if you look at the history of cosmology, for example, you'll notice that the oscillating universe model at one time was very popular, a thoroughly Hindu concept.
Wait a second. It may be compatible with the Hindu view, but I wouldn't say that it would be a Hindu concept.
Well, the reincarnating universe is really the heart of Hindu theology, if indeed we were able to prove.
Oh, in the sense of the cyclical view of time.
Correct, and the cyclical view of the universe.
Yeah, they could still be right. We might just be in a section of a very, very long cycle.
Well, I mean, that's my whole point, is that we have these different theological perspectives on the universe, and now we have the scientific tools to actually put these different concepts to the test. And so, for example, the steady-state model is no longer held as a viable explanation of the universe, and that has been very disturbing to people of a particular theological persuasion. But hey, that's the way the cookies crumble on the theological table. And we should look at this as a great scientific advance. And one thing I try to do in the book is say, you know, this is a tool to really make science education exciting again. You know, we start letting people know just how powerful a tool science is, not just to deal with the nerdy things, but also philosophy and theology. Maybe we can get the public much more interested in science education again, and then maybe we can let the theologians and the philosophers out there relax a little bit when they recognize, hey, there's actually some hard science we can bring to bear on these issues.
Well, I think the theologians are going to be kind of unpersuaded of that, because I think the history of science has been that it's been extremely fruitful for any number of religious as well as philosophical traditions. It allows for a great deal of stimulation of philosophical and religious thought without really compelling any. But I think here again is where we may have to agree to disagree, and perhaps your predictions will bear this out one way or the other. As you pointed out, I tend to deal with the with the more complicated sciences, since I come from the field of biology and you're a physicist. I'm glad you put it that way, by the way, because it is very annoying for a biologist to have physics and chemistry referred to as the hard scientists, because we really have the difficult science.
Oh, I totally agree.
And you understand that, and that's great.
Yeah, I mean,
but
I got...
When you look at biological complexity, and of course this is one of the great enthusiasms of the intelligent design proponents, when you look at biological complexity, it's extremely difficult to discern from that any particular religious or philosophical perspective. I'm a materialist. I'm not a theist in my personal beliefs, but I don't believe that the evidence from a biological complexity or other phenomena that we can observe in the biological world compels a materialistic point of view. Neither does it compel a theistic point of view. It provides support for any number of views, but compels none, and that's kind of my position.
Areas of biology where we do have a significantly greater simplicity. I mean, I think of the origin of life, where we can look at the chemistry and the physics, and see if the chemistry and the physics can yield biology by strictly natural process. Here, we're doing something that's orders of magnitude simpler than the fossil record issues or the origin of humanity. But even on the origin of humanity, as you're well aware, the Christian perspective on that is that human beings are unique with respect to all other creatures of life.
Well, one Christian perspective is that is. I mean, there are some, you know, there are Christian perspectives which do not object to human abilities developing gradually from simpler forms.
Yeah, I'm referring to the spirit nature of humanity. I think that is one area where virtually all Christians would agree that human beings are the only species with a spirit nature, and that's an area where science can certainly throw some weight in.
I would have a tough time imagining how science could demonstrate a spirit nature. What science can do is study things like consciousness. It can study things like symbolic communication. It can study phenomena like empathy and other human emotions and abilities. But whether or not there is a spirit nature in the sense of a soul or something that is non-material is just, by definition, outside of the bailiwick of what science can study.
Let me give you an example of that. I mean, we can start looking at brain structures of different hominids, for example, and see which of those brain structures would even have the capacity to support spiritual activity. We could look at archaeological
evidence. Spiritual
activity
is kind of a general term. I mean, if you're talking about a soul, are you talking about...
No, I'm talking about simple things like the capacity to meditate, to be... You know, aware of, you know, be self-aware.
Oh, self-awareness. We went on that one. Self-awareness,
you know,
is something that is quite common among higher mammals.
No,
they
I
can
mean,
identify.
Questions like, why am I here? What is my role and purpose in the universe?
Well, I don't think we have quite time to get into those questions,
heck.
Dr. Ross. But
I
just love just being able to listen to both. I'm just sitting here just soaking it all up, and I love it. I wanted to, again, just for my listeners, this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Tani Tenuvial on What Would Arwen Do with Dr. Hugh Ross, the author of Creation is Science, A Testable Model Approach to End the Creation Evolution Wars, and my other guest, Dr. Eugenie Scott, author of Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools. Both of those books just came out recently, just within, I believe, the last month, and are both are available. Are they both available now through Amazon.com, I believe?
I'm afraid that Not in Our Classrooms has been delayed. I have an advanced copy of it. It was supposed to be shipped on the 6th of September, and now they told me that it won't be shipped until the 20th. So, alas. But it's available on, you can always pre-order it on Amazon. It's coming out. It's published by Beacon Press.
And Dr. Scott, the website for the National... Center. This is always such a
National Center for Science Education.
Yes,
it's a whole lot of words.
Yes. So yeah, it's at www.natcen.
No, and that's actually not a very good domain name.
Oh, there's a better one.
If you go to www.n as in national, c as in center, s as in science, e as in education, w as in web, e as in education, b as in boy, ncseweb.org.
Great.
That'll get you to what you need to know.
And that has, on that website, there's information about your upcoming lectures and speaking engagements, of which there are many. You're going to be in New York pretty soon, aren't you? We have some listeners that listen online, I believe.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes,
and also
right.
About
Rochester Institute of Technology on the 20th.
Yes.
And up in Oregon at the end of the month, Eugene, Oregon on the 28th. At any rate, I'll be here in Yon. And anyway, they can check the website for that information.
Yes. And Dr. Ross, the website for Reasons to Believe is www.reasons.org. And Dr. Ross, you're going to be right here in Orange County next week at Saddleback Church. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, a large church, which I'm glad it is a large church, because I know that will be a packed out.
I'm going to run into Eugenie, and we're going to be at the University of Rochester I think early October.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to wave. I'll be there on the 20th, so
okay.
I'll miss
right.
you.
Yeah, well, and if you'd like more information about that event with Dr. Ross, that's next Thursday, actually. You can call 949-609-8000 or visit the website at www.reasons.org. And, you know, I was wondering if it would be possible. I'd like for both of you, just because to me it's very interesting, the concept of I'm actually kind of not sure where I stand on a lot of this, but it does seem to me sometimes like with regards to evolution, I wonder is there really enough time for that to have happened?
Yeah.
And I'd like for both of you to just speak to that, perhaps. You know, is there really enough time in the billions of years? And maybe even touch just briefly on like this thing called the Cambrian explosion, where all of a sudden all these life forms just show up. And Dr. Scott, could you maybe speak to that first, and then I'd like Dr. Ross to give us a perspective on that too, because I just don't know quite what to make of it.
It's not a problem. There, the Cambrian explosion is something that's used by a lot of creationists to try to indicate that evolution is weak science or that it just cannot make the grade because there are all these handicaps. Cambrian explosion is presented as a severe problem for evolution, and that's just nonsense. The Cambrian explosion, number one, took anywhere from 20 to 30 billion, 30 million years. So it's an explosion only in the geological sense. That's pretty leisurely when it comes to changes which take place in populations. So the Cambrian explosion is a fascinating period of evolutionary history when the main body plans of invertebrates showed up. You don't get lions and tigers and bears. Okay? You get wiggly stuff. You get worms, you get stuff with segments, you get stuff with appendages, you get early forms of things like mollusks and arthropods and varmints like that. You don't get the kind of snazzy stuff that you know, you don't get vertebrates and creatures like that, except some very, very primitive fish-like things way at the end of the Cambrian. So it's not quite the explosion that people think it is, and there's enough time for it.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's more data, more fossil data that puts the roots of some of these groups further back into the pre-Cambrian period. Jellyfish, for example, go back to the pre-Cambrian. And there are a couple of other worm-like forms that traces of which we have back in the Precambrian. So the Cambrian explosion is a big problem for evolution, is really a big creationist myth.
Well, Dr. Ross, how would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, the scholars I know in China are claiming that the Cambrian explosion window has got to be less than 2 million years wide. Some of them are even saying less than a million years wide. I think this is an area that can be put to the test. I mean, there is a lot more research that can be done on the Cambrian explosion, and let's do that research. I think we should also be doing research on a number of other mass speciation events, particularly those that follow the mass extinction events, these giant asteroids that hit the Earth and this gamma ray bursts that likewise do wipe out significant fractions of life on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so we make a number of predictions on that basis in the book. In terms of a time window that I think is much more accessible to measurement would be the origin of life, because there we've got two independent scientific tools for dating the time window for the origin of life. We can look at the cratering on the Moon and Mars and Mercury to date the late heavy bombardment. We can also date the late heavy bombardment by looking at the dynamics of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and the Kuiper Belt. And they both come up with the same date, 3.85 billion years ago. And then particularly the Kuiper Belt measurements allow us to determine the intensity of the late heavy bombardment. And it is such that it turns the entire surface of the Earth into a liquid magma ocean at least 200 kilometers deep, with a temperature in excess of 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Obviously not the conditions that would be conducive to prebiotic chemistry. And yet carbon-12 to carbon-13 analysis, as well as nitrogen and sulfur isotope analysis, tells us that life was abundant on planet Earth 3.80 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. And it takes 50 million years for the late heavy bombardment to subside adequately that liquid water and solid rocks can form. Well, you can do the math. That leaves you with a geologic instant of time for the origin of life. And likewise, those same isotope signatures tell us that planet Earth never had prebiotics. If there's no prebiotic soup and there's no time for the origin of life, then this undercuts the naturalistic explanation for life's origins. Naturalistic models need an abundance of time and an abundance of prebiotics, and the scientific evidence tells us there is neither. And it is such that, for example, the Santa Fe Institute, which is non-theistic research scientists, are saying, well, we're not going to accept God as the explanation, but we think it's a hidden law of physics, what they call a fourth law of thermodynamics. But the problem from an astronomical perspective is you can't hide such a fourth law from observational detection.
Well, you've both given us a lot to think about, and I think, you know, as Dr. Scott mentioned earlier, there is a very complex, these are also all very complex issues, and certainly nothing we can cover in the space of about a half hour, which is the wonderful thing about the fact that you both have books. In fact, you both have several books that people, but the most recent from Dr. Ross being Creation as Science, A Testable Model Approached in the Creation Evolution Wars, and the latest from Dr. Scott, which will be available September 20th, Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools. And we just have about 5 minutes left. I was wondering, gosh, if I could just ask each of you to maybe just say a few remarks. I guess my whole thing is I find all of this very fascinating. For me, it's not the most important thing to know why. And I know for some people it is. For me, it's enough to know that things happened. And my faith is very important to me. But it doesn't challenge my faith to wrestle with these things. And so I like what Dr. Scott, what you said about that. It's not necessarily either or. There are several positions all across the board. Would you just say a few words to our listeners, maybe to encourage them to continue to pursue looking at these things, and but also to treat each other with kindness. One of the things I want to thank both of you that I appreciate so much from both of you is your just being so courteous to each other. I see people get into head-hitting debates over these things, and I think that these are things that we can discuss and look at and have rigorous conversations about, but still have respect for each other's and for each other's ideas. Could you speak a little bit to that, and then Dr. Ross, perhaps some parting remarks as well?
Well, I think Hugh and I agree about many things in terms of the history of the universe. We both agree that the history is that the universe is billions of years old. He's been strongly criticized by the young Earth creationists for this, I think very unfairly. We both agree that galaxies and planets developed gradually. They weren't just poofed into existence over a short period of time. Where we tend to part company is about biological evolution. Mm-hmm. Biological evolution is the idea that living things have common ancestors, what Darwin called the descent with modification of modern forms from earlier different ancestors. And Hugh has a rather more limited view of this as what I would characterize as a progressive creationist point of view, where God created consecutively through time, first living things and maybe some intermediates, and the Cambrian explosion is for many creationists an example of God specially creating these body plans, which supposedly could not have originated from common ancestors. You know, may as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. If the physical universe can evolve, why can't the biological universe? If you can get variation within the kind and evolution within a mollusk lineage or evolution within a mammal lineage, why not have mammals and mollusks ultimately coming back to a common ancestor? The idea of common ancestry is not incompatible with the idea of the Creator God, yes. But it is incompatible with the idea of special creation, that God creates mollusks and mammoths as separately created entities which cannot be brought back to a common ancestor. Well, and that's where we disagree.
Yes, and thank you, Dr. Scott. Dr. Russ, we just have like 2 minutes, if you could just give a quick response to that. And then again, because I want to give out information about both of you, your websites,
sure.
And your books, but we just have like 2 minutes.
Well, I think Scott is right that you know, the Bible doesn't claim special creation for all species. Basically the higher animals, the soulless creatures and human beings, and leaves the other question open for scientific investigation. I would like to make the point that no creationist or evolutionist can claim to have the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one area where Eugenie and I agree, is that nobody has the whole story yet.
Okay.
However, we look at science as powerful enough to develop that story to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should give everybody the freedom to do the research that's necessary to take it to that next level, recognizing that though we never will know everything, we can certainly learn more. Or to take the biblical perspective on it, quoting the Apostle Paul, everything must be tested, hold fast to that which is good.
Right.
And hopefully we can accumulate more and more good knowledge as we continue to do this scientific research. And as the Supreme Court noted, we can't use the Constitution to force bad science into the public school classroom, but neither can we use it to force good science out.
Yes.
So the science is high quality. We should let it in regardless of the theological implications.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a free country. It's not the Soviet Union. Let's let science do the business that it is. I like to look at science as a brutal competition among ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the more vigorous we can exercise that testing, the better. And if it has philosophical implications, well, so be it. That just makes science all the more exciting.
Yes. Well, thank you both so much, Dr. Scott and Dr. Russ, for being on the show today. And I will leave you with an elvish greeting. Elen Sela Lumen Amenti Elvo, a star shines on the hour of our meeting. I hope, Dr. Scott, I'll get to meet you one day soon. And hopefully, Dr. Russ, I'll be seeing you before too long. But again, thank you both for coming on the program today.
You certainly are welcome.
You're welcome, too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Safe journeys, you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And this is Tani Tenuvio wrapping it up today for What Would Arwen Do? Please stay tuned for Barbara coming up next. Very special guest, Writers on Writing, with author Joe Esterhaas. Talking about his new book, The Devil's Guide to Hollywood. And so please stay tuned for that at 5 o'clock. And again, my guests were Dr. Hugh Ross, the author of Creation as Science, a Testable Model Approach to End the Creation-Evolution Wars. The website, if you'd like more information about that book, or Dr. Ross and the organization Reasons to Believe, please visit www.reasons.org. And Dr. Eugenie Scott, author of Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools, and she's executive director of the National Center for Science Education, NCSE. And you'll have to Google that because it has a very complicated web address. But if you'd like more information about her speaking engagements and her book, please visit that website. And Dr. Ross will be here in Orange County next week, Thursday, at Saddleback Church, and you can get information about that at www.reasons.org. And so that about wraps it up for What Would Arwen Do? An Elvish Perspective on Life, Community, and the Arts.